Welcome to another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Kate Clinton is hilarious and so on the money. She has been described as the most talented lesbian comedian ever, but her audience extends well beyond the gay community. There isn't a topic she doesn't tackle, and thankfully, nothing is off limits. The playwright Tony Kushner posed this question: is it possible to be incredibly funny and at the same time a political visionary? His answer? Kate Clinton will show you that it's more than possible by being both. Clinton's stand-up act takes her all over. In fact, she's on her world-famous Sis Boom Ba tour, which is making stops throughout the U.S. and Canada. In addition to her comedy appearances on stage and TV, she's appeared on GMA, Entertainment Tonight, MSNBC, CNN, to name a few. Kate's been on the big screen, too, in several documentaries, including this year's Out in America. And then there are her irreverent and liberating YouTube video updates and her books. She's written three: Don't Get Me Started, What the L, and I Told You So. Her blogs can be found on the Huffington Post, The Progressive, to name two. She's written for the New York Times, Women's Review of Books, and The Advocate. Then there's The Communicate, her quarterly email newsletter. The list of her articles, essays, and editorials is endless. Clinton has worked extensively with social justice and nonprofit groups and has been a regular MC at major fundraising events and dinners for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, the Ms. Foundation, the ACLU, and the NYC LGBT Center. This year, Clinton celebrates her 31st year of performing. Kate Clinton, welcome, and thanks for stopping by.
I'm tired just listening to that.
I'm exhausted.
I could lie down. And I don't think you said I also have 9 CDs.
No, I didn't say that.
That is, wow.
That's
but I think of a CD, or I used to call it a record, as a record of what I was doing then. So it's kind of recorded somewhere.
Okay, so that you didn't have to go out of your way to do that.
Yeah.
So that's not that impressive.
Thank you. I'll tell my people.
I want to talk about how you started in stand-up. You began in 1981, mm-hmm. right? How did you know you were funny? And how did you know what to do? Talk to me about that and your background. And
Before I started stand-up comedy, I was a high school English teacher.
So does that make you funny?
You learn to work a room. 11th and 12th graders are a very tough audience. I learned from teaching not to say anything important in the first 3 minutes because they were looking at what you were wearing.
And commenting on that?
Still, in their heads. Well, this I taught back in the years of pantyhose.
Okay.
Remember that? And one year, I remember one day, that some reason I put these pantyhose on and I got to school and they had just like let go. All the elastic was gone. So
you were sagging?
Classic elephant ankles. And I was taking the roll and I looked up and I realized everyone was looking at my feet. So I just stepped in the waste paper basket.
You conducted class from in the garbage can.
Yes, and I hopped along. I never said a word, and they totally went along with it at that point. So, I mean, it was great training, you know, and I love what I do now, but I learned when I first started, I learned from teaching not to go into a blind murderous panic if things weren't going well and leave the room.
Right,
just keep going on. Plus, you don't know. With high school kids, you know, you don't know how you're affecting them. Their whole, it's just very mono face.
I was just going to say they can just stare at you, if in fact they are staring at you and not doing something else.
Hopefully. So, you know, and when you are in front of a comedy audience, sometimes they're having a great time, but they don't really laugh. And they come out after and say, oh, we really love that. And I have to say,
thanks for
this
sharing.
Is how I would know. You know, like
right,
that.
Right.
So, I mean, I learned a lot of things in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm middle child. I have two older brothers, younger brother and sister. And
you mean to find your place? I'm over here kind of thing?
You know, no, it was sort of like, well, the three brothers all played football. So during the off season, I was like the tackling ram. And if I could make them laugh, then they would get weak and I knew I was safe.
Safe, yeah.
And I'm from a very hyper-Catholic family.
Now, what does that mean?
Well, we said I went to Mass every morning with my mom.
Wow.
We were fundamentalists, but we were kind of we were the old school that, you know, you also visited the sick and, you know, you did that kind of good stuff. It wasn't all just, I hate the homosexuals. although I did get that message somewhere. So, you know, I just think that I learned a lot of being like an outsider and observational stuff. But we said a rosary after dinner every night. Everybody would kneel down by their chairs. And that was my early comedy work, because I would try to get my brothers in trouble by making them laugh.
During something
very serious. Yeah. So
now,
there was that.
Was there a given that some of your siblings, if not you, would have a career in the church?
Oh, my oldest brother was in the seminary for 8 years, and then he left and got drafted and went to Vietnam. Then my older brother, just older than me, was at West Point. He left there and went in the Christian Brothers. And in the space of 6 months, it was like a major uniform change. Everybody's like, what is everybody wearing today? I don't know. So, and I was heavily recruited to be a nun.
And?
I just didn't have the calves. I just didn't have those.
Did you ever entertain the possibility that you would be Sister Kate Clinton? Well,
no.
They'd give you another name, right?
I'd be like Sister Daniel. Something like that. Sister Mary Columkill. I was in love with Julie Andrews, but that did not lead me to an idea that I had a vocation in the church. Contrary.
Well, thank God.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay. Well, yeah. No, I never did. I never wanted to.
So did you have good, aside from being a teacher, was your home life good training to be a comedian? You certainly could mine what was going on in your household, no?
Absolutely. I was, I was like the entertainer. Annoyingly, I think, to some of my brothers, because I would just cut people.
Uh-huh.
But I made my mother laugh, and that was fun. And my mother had a very dry Irish humor. You know, she would get together with this other friend of hers, and they would start the list of, you know, who was sick and who died, and they would get hysterical. And I thought, oh, my God, that's wild. But what was the question?
The question was, mine material from growing up?
I got a lot of material from growing up, but I'll tell you, one of the really critical influences on my life was my best friend in high school's mother was my comedy mom, really. I mean, I would go to their house, and she was a doctor's wife, so she had a little more free time than my mom did. And she would just make time for me, and she would say, okay, sit down and listen to this record, and we would listen to Mike Nichols and Elaine May. She would call me and say, Channel 4 right now, and I would turn on Channel 4, and there would be Bette Midler and Merv Griffin for the first time.
So she saw something in you, didn't she?
She would make me perform. I she got the Fredericks of Hollywood catalog before anybody, and she would just found humor. She would do that and showed me how to do it, or just modeled. And then they would get these hilarious long Christmas letters every year.
Oh, from family letters, right?
Family letters, but also people that her husband had been their doctor and, you know, other
doctors. Those are the most presumptuous pieces of mail I've ever read.
And she would give them all to me and sit down in her chair and give me a letter and say, okay, read this one in a German accent. And, you know,
she's
93.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and she is
probably
still
your biggest fan, right?
Hilarious. I mean, I was there the other day visiting her, and she lives in Syracuse, and she's still at home. She's totally, you know, got everything around her, and she's hilarious. And I was talking to her, and her daughter came home. I was talking to her for about 20 minutes. Her daughter came home and said, Mom, turn on your hearing aid. I thought, oh, great. So I confessed, you know, like really heavy things, but not really. But then she put her hearing aid in. There was something wrong with it. There was some sound. And she made this face and imitated the sound. And I really lost it. I've never laughed harder at anybody other than her and her daughter.
So you're her biggest fan.
Oh, absolutely. It was mutual. Totally mutual.
So you go into teaching, and you do this for 8 years, you
mm-hmm.
said. And
mm-hmm.
then what made you decide to make the switch?
Well, it was
when did
sort
you become
of the
emboldened?
80s was the beginning of the comedy boom. There was, you know, everything was, you know, the laundries were being turned into yuck-yucks. And I started saying that I wanted to try stand-up comedy. And I started talking about it. And literally what happened was my best friend booked me in a club, and she said, "You're on in a month. I don't want to hear about it anymore."
Upstate? Which, where you grew up?
In Syracuse.
Okay, not here.
Yeah.
Upstate.
No, I came up. So I did it that night. 180 of my closest friends came. It was like a codependency meeting. Everybody's like, "She's funny. She's funny." Everybody laughing. And then a couple of weeks later, I did a show in Boston, and nobody laughed at things that they laughed at 2 weeks prior. But I knew from teaching, just keep going. Just keep doing it. And I was getting toward the end mercifully, and this voice from the back of the room in Boston, big Southie accent, went, "You're on your own, darling." And I thought, oh, God, I really am. But, you know, I kept doing it. My partner at the time became my manager, something I don't recommend, but we're good friends now.
Okay.
And I had a friend who'd been in women's music in a band for about 10 years, and the band broke up, and she said to me, "I will book you for the summer." And she booked me for 5 years.
All over the place?
All over the place. And she, I mean, I came up, and I'm very happy about it, through a really active women's music and cultural network that was just booming. And you sort of, I mean, I didn't start in comedy clubs. I started in Unitarian basements. I prayed to the unit to this day. And then, you know, you'd play downstairs, and then you'd play up in the vestry, and you knew you'd made it.
Made it.
And then
right.
there were concert, giant concerts, and so that's where I came up. And I'm just really thankful for that. That is not as much present as it used to be. I mean, the whole thing has changed, which has been, you know, an astounding. I mean, it's not only a 32-year career, but it's a 32-year perspective on an LGBT movement, which I'm very happy to have been part of.
But when you first started out mm-hmm. at this Unitarian church and doing starting the summer in Boston, mm-hmm. were you still teaching?
No, I had left. I had left teaching and went. And the only way I could leave teaching and get a leave of absence was I said that I was attending a school, you know, it was like you had
whatever.
And so I had a friend who was running a writing center out in Cazenovia, New York, just outside of Syracuse. And I said, "Would you vouch for me that I'm coming to your school?" And she said, "Sure." And so I went. I had no intention of going and staying, but I went and I got totally hooked because I had been in college and graduate school before women's studies. So me, it was always the Whale and Melville and, "Oh, please, what is, you know, what about the ladies left at home, you know, like
widow's walk,
you know, that, like, what were they doing?" Well, and so I started to catch up in the reading that I had missed. And we would do, and then we were also writing, and we would go around to, you know, nursing homes and
perform,
do our readings, and, you know, you'd be reading at this in the solarium at some nursing home, and but he would be like, "Pep it up." And, you know, the poetry was sort of, you know, "The tide goes in, the tide goes out. I hate my mother." And then it would be me. And I was writing a story at the time, and it was funny. And I kept thinking, maybe I should go more directly for the jokes. And that's when I really started talking about really writing a routine.
That you culled from your life, or you went outside of your life? Were you being more of an observer, or were you being more personal?
It was really personal. It was about coming out.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that. When did that happen? And how emboldened did you feel about coming out back then?
I felt not the way. I mean, it was in the 19, like probably 79. I'm a latecomer, but I believe I've made up for lost time. I didn't come out to anybody, then I got a microphone. Okay. Once I was comfortable with it and I had been with my friend, you know, and we would do the classic, you know, somebody would come over and you'd straighten up, you know, that whole thing.
Was this college, around college?
No, let's see, probably about 5 years into my teaching.
Okay. So, yep. this was something that you knew about?
I knew forever.
Forever. And squelched it?
Totally squelched it. I somehow got the message. It wasn't as clear in the Catholic Church as it has been recently that it wasn't a good thing and I was going to end up in hell, but somehow I got the message. So I didn't, you know, when I think about my experience coming up through school, it was a very dissociative. I mean, I was putting so much energy in trying not to come out that it's sort of like being in an emotional blackout. and you don't, you know, you're not fully participating. You're not banging all 12 cylinders when you're in your own life, right. Which I think is one of the tragedies of people not coming out. Although, you know, the average age of kids coming out now is something like 13.
Really?
It's astounding. And I'm really happy they don't have to waste all of that time. Their consequences of that is they're really hideously bullied.
The secret that you were carrying around, was that like a bag of rocks for you that you were just schlepping behind you?
No, it wasn't that. I probably would have had a cross anyway.
Touché.
Also would, but whatever. I don't like to suffer. You know, it was it was kind of just this kind of veneer of sadness. Even though I was funny and everything, it was just like I knew something you didn't know.
Right.
And it was just sad, you know, and I thought I was going to be. And the message was, you know, if you're I was little and my mom said, you know, about marriage. I said, I'm not getting married. She said, well, when you have kids, I said, I'm not having kids. And I, you know, that used to be how you could be if you were gay. Now you have to get married.
you have to have children.
Right. You have to go in the military. Boy, what happened?
Leave me alone.
don't want to. You know, it was just sad when I think about it. It was just sad. I thought I was going to be, like, grow up. I'd be a spinster next to my oldest brother's fireplace darning socks, you know.
There's an image.
I know. It's Silas Marner damage, I think. But, I have an extraordinary rich life.
But who would have thought?
I didn't think.
Exactly.
That I would make my living and be able to buy things as an out lesbian comedian.
And mine your sexuality.
What?
And also, not only mine it, but educate people.
And just be it.
And just be it.
And be it and be comfortable in it and happy about it. And that, I mean, you know, I've done amazing things. I've been in amazing places. But when someone comes up and says, you know, I didn't ever really think that I could be out and happy and I saw you. And it really changed me, or I saw you on television. I mean, I had a woman, young woman, I was on the, and I'm sorry to say this, I don't say this, but I was on the Maury Povich show.
Oh, well.
Early on. And the topic was lesbian comedians, and there were three of us, and some guy stood up in the audience, he said, well, you wouldn't even be on the show if you weren't a lesbian. And I was like, well, that's the point.
That's the title.
Hence the title of the show. And Maury turned to me and said, yes, why are you on this show? And I got very righteous, and I said, we were told we were going to meet Connie Chung.
Great.
But
great.
So a young woman is home from college. She's lying on the couch. She's suicidal. And she sees me and sees us and says, I don't have to. So when somebody comes up and tells me that story.
How great is
that?
What
an amazing. People would love. I know people who would love to have that impact on just one person.
I wondered, you know, I was toying with the idea when I was writing this introduction of saying that you've been described as the most talented lesbian comedian. And I really wrestled with that. Do you want to be the most talented Catholic comedian, the most talented, comedian with short hair? I don't know. How do you feel about that being part of the description of you?
You know, I think we've passed over the word lesbian pretty quickly. We're now into queer and like whatever happened. We were just getting ready. You know, people were just being able to say lesbian without spitting up.
Really?
And so I'm happy to identify that way. It is self-selecting, but I have always believed, my feminist heart has always believed that concept of women loving women is not a narrow concept and that it actually includes everyone. You know, I'm a woman loving a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Let's all love women. I think it could help the world. You know, so I know people wrestle with it. I know it's been very interesting to watch comedians who were lesbian closeted and, you know, would never, and then it got to be, hey, this is a good thing. Suddenly they're coming out.
Let me capitalize
on
this.
Yeah, so that's great. You know, I'm happy about it. I'm happy.
And it's really an integral part of your act and your politics.
Mm-hmm.
Describe your stand-up process. Is it stream of consciousness? Do you test material out on others? What's a day in the life of? You're on this tour. Are you doing the same stand-up every night?
I love to write. Until I'm writing, and then I hate it. I really would love to be on stage, but when I'm on stage, I wish I were home writing, or at least not circling Newark. You know, But I do love to write, and I am happy that I have these other outlets, writing columns and doing that kind of thing. But my process is I read a lot. I have periods of the year where I'm just on a lot of input, and I'm taking things in, and I'm reading. I think of my material as, and I think, I can't remember, I think it might have been Jay Leno. I think of a show as sort of like a newspaper. You know, we start off with the day's news. Mm-hmm. You talk about the place, and then you can get into the opinion section, the sports section, the media analysis. So I sort of think of it that way. The booker that I had been in music. So I said to her, well, what should a show be? Now, she's a musician. So she said, well, I guess what you'll do is you'll do 45 minutes, we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and you'll do 45 more. That's 90 minutes out of the gate. And, you know, and I had friends who were trying to perfect their 8 minutes. And since I would
90 minutes.
So I would go back to places every year and a half. I felt you got to do new stuff. So I really got in the habit of writing a lot, which I love, actually. And so, I mean, I have periods where, like, sort of in the holiday months, not a lot's happening, or I don't want to be part of it. So I have sort of fallow periods, which are where, you know,
and that's
oh, it's wonderful.
Because, I mean, my God, it seems like you never stop.
And then you take notes, and then you start shaping it for, you know, as the year goes on. And I work in Provincetown in the summer.
Summer.
For
that's where
July
I saw you.
August.
Mm-hmm.
And July and August are wonderful because then I get to try stuff out. And a wonderful 3 pages of total brilliance after 2 shows can be like a throwaway line, literally. But being with an audience and hearing them react to something, that those things grow. You know, so it's a really creative, really, you're really working the material. So when I go out in the fall, I have a pretty good idea of what
sense
the show's going to be.
I read that you were called am I pronouncing this correctly, a fuminist?
A feminist
humorist, which would then speak to the fact that you probably never would run out of material.
Right. Ever.
And thank you all. In Washington,
yeah.
I mean, you must have had a frickin' field day.
You can get lazy, though, because it was just, I felt a lot of times I would just say, what happened, and turn my head.
Right.
I didn't really have to make anything up. But I think one of the jobs of what and I'm very prepared when you ask me about my show. I do have a lesson plan.
Habits die hard.
I can't get over it. But having that, I feel that I can improv from that. I don't enjoy people who just go on
stage. Sure, I understand.
Where are you from? Pittsburgh.
Right, and then, right.
So I'm very, very planned. There are different sections. I've certainly had the Catholic Church to talk about forever.
How did you feel about Pope Francis?
Well, Franny. So
to his friends.
Franny. We'll see. You know, I was interested when he said, you know, was asked the question about the gay priests, and he said, you know, if a gay man is searching for Jesus in his heart, who am I to judge? And I thought, did he just come out? It sounded like, well, been there, done that. Mm-hmm.
Let's move
on. BTDT. You know, and there's still... I'm certainly a huge change and wonderful. I don't know if it's just a kinder, gentler form of a really crushing patriarchy. I mean, the day that he said, why are we so crazy about abortion? And, you know, the next day he spoke to a Catholic gynecologist and said, abortion's still on. You know, we're still against it.
Right. So hold on a second, everybody.
So we'll see. But it certainly tonally is pretty amazing. And you just have to wonder what it would be ex-Benedict. It would be. if he were, you know, in the little mother-in-law
cottage.
And isn't
that creepy? Yeah. What are you doing on
What's
my property?
What's he doing? Is he back here like, oh, like him
or just,
better?
You know, pressing that one button and, you know, Francis Benedict here, come over. I want
Can't
you here.
Hear you.
Right. You talk personally as well. And you also make points in what you have to say. Like your vlog on Like a Benefit, which I just loved so much. You spent some time talking about how the word like drives you crazy, and it drives me crazy too, but I must add, not as much as the word awesome does. How does somebody walk into a room and say, this is awesome? I don't get that. You know what's awesome? The Grand Canyon is awesome. That's awesome. But I loved your suggestion to mark down every time somebody used the word like, and then gather all that money and write a check to GLSEN, which is the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. And my point about it is that you take humor to make a point here. And you get this organization out there. I never heard of GLSEN, you know, and I think that's so fabulous.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I think that, you know, there's lots of debates about serious is more serious, truthful, something to be listened to, and comedy is just sort of lightweight and, well, not serious. And mm-hmm. But I think actually comedy can carry the weight of a lot of serious material more than serious can carry the weight of something comic.
You can really make a better point.
Absolutely. I believe in humor activism.
Another one of your entries, this is also from April, and it was Thatcher Dies. And that got gay men very upset because they thought they saw a hashtag that read Thatcher Dies, but they thought it said that Cher Dies. That's spelled the same way, but it wasn't
great.
So. And then you said, as for Margaret Thatcher, may she rust in peace. May the Iron Lady rust in peace. I mean, now.
Rust, that, I think it was rust in peace.
Didn't I say rust?
Did you?
I meant, certainly, and rest in peace is not funny. Rust in peace. But did that just come to you? Sit there and kind of. How can I do this? I
mean, well, the video blogs are fun because as prepared as I am for a show, in a video blog, the vlog, I have maybe three things
that you want to touch
that
upon.
I want to touch upon
in less than
but
2 minutes.
But I don't know what's going to happen, and I do it, I repeat it. I'll do maybe 10, 15 takes, and then finally I'll get that one and go. That's it. That's the last one, and then I just put it up on YouTube.
And you do this by yourself. Mm-hmm. So I know when I know is mm-hmm. what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But do you also try things out on people like your partner? Does she think you're funny?
She is very funny. But she's Indian and she's Indian. She's funny, but she's Indian. Oh, Lord. Sounds like the partition's coming. It's English is a second language.
So there may be nuances that she misses?
She loves puns.
Oh.
She loves broad, physical humor. I mm-hmm. mean, if you are at a table and you drop your elbow off the table, she is on the floor. She's the most sophisticated thinker you'd ever meet, but it's that kind of humor mm-hmm. that will drop her to the floor. She does think I'm funny, but I don't. Not until she pays, I don't waste it at home. But no, I try it. I do try it on my friends. I do try lines on my friends, and they know now. They will call me out and go, "Are you working that one?" Oh yeah, what do you think? It's good,
mm-hmm.
maybe. But I have a problem. I think I have joke dyslexia. Often I think a punchline is really the setup, and it's confusing. But then sometimes I think. Don't even finish it. I think...
You could just throw it out there, you mean,
go ahead.
An idea and not
well,
have
what
it.
I love about humor is you say something, everybody laughs at the one same time.
Uh-huh.
But you don't know why. You don't... And it can, for every person's there, it's several different reasons. So it's like the multiplicity of the responses, the oneness mm-hmm. of the response at that one moment. To me, that's the essence of democracy. It's like all this multiplicity... as one, but everybody is still individual.
Exactly, and taking still, their own thing
yeah.
away. That, I was thinking about that, too, that that's what's so great about somebody like you. You're not only funny, but there's a point to be made, and that somebody in the audience can say, yes,
mm-hmm.
exactly, through the humor, the point is made. It's not just making fun of somebody mm-hmm. or pointing out something silly.
I mean, I've done my share of slash and burn, but I don't really, I like to come basically from a place of love, not hate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's a difference. I'm not interested in a kind of. I like more of a. I wonder sometimes how humor would have been different if it weren't locked in a comedy club, and I emphasis on comedy clubs,
mm-hmm.
but it were more circular, more narrative instead of
what
like
do you mean?
Stand up, sit down. You,
you
know,
mean
like,
you're just sitting around with a group of people?
That it's more narrative, and the expectation is that not that you get a setup and then a delivery, which I think is very male. You know, it's like up and down and up and down. That it would be more
nuanced,
more circular, more extended story.
Mm-hmm.
But the confines of a club where you have 10 minutes or you're going to be on a show, that's why the beauty of the internet and being able to just do your own thing and
sure.
do your own vlog and see what happens.
The freedom
is great.
Is amazing.
It's great. I want to get paid for it.
I understand. I also just must ask you clearly about you and the Tea Party and Hillary Clinton. Are you ready for a woman to be president?
Absolutely. I've been ready a long time.
Yeah, really.
I just think, how is she going to do it? She's my age. I just think, really?
Yeah, as from the exhausted perspective?
Yeah, don't you just want to, like, have a coffee and do the crossword puzzle in the morning out in the backyard?
And nobody bother me. Nobody hawk me.
Yeah, just like, and it's going to be so vicious. It's already vicious. I mean, she's got a thick skin. At least she knows what she's up against. I don't think Barack Obama really knew how.
Why does anybody want the job? And, oh, I'm here. I'm going to help the American people. Whatever it is. Who needs it?
Well, it's not you and me. I mean, I would never. Thank God there are gerontology nurses, you know. So there are people that like this sort of thing.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I would
you
never.
Know,
yes, exactly.
So, you know.
I'm not taking care of my husband when he's old. older.
God bless him. But it's not something I would do. But I really think it gets in your blood, definitely. There are people that just live and breathe this.
And think that this is their calling.
Mm-hmm. And good. I think we need public servants. I applaud people who run for local offices,
smoke crack cocaine when they're mayors of large cities.
Well, you know. It was. But I'm in Canada. It doesn't count.
Right. Yeah, Canada's a whole different animal.
It's okay.
I could go on much longer, but we really have to stop.
Really?
And what else would you like to say? I'm cool. What didn't we talk about?
It was totally fun.
But, I mean, is there anything that you would like to share? A word of wisdom? A gem?
Well, I have to say that the government shutdown made me shut down. I've just been feeling really, really shut down. But I had the opportunity of being at a conference with lots of young people. And they're just doing such exciting things. And they're making do with a really different horizon. And it's very exciting to me. I'm sorry.
So you feel a little buoyed
absolutely. I don't,
positive.
You know, I could get. But, you know, it's sometimes people are like, where's the next movement? And, you know, we don't recognize it because it doesn't look like anything we thought of. Kids are doing, young people are doing amazing multi-issued work. And gender is like, what? LGBT? They're so beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really quite exciting.
Really have turned a corner here.
Absolutely. I think so.
So we feel positive and good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a great way to end, don't you think?
I think so.
As opposed to being down and depressed.
Really doing the doom Tourette's. Yeah, no. Let's not.
Kate Clinton, who's funnier than you are and who's nicer than you are, I had the best time with you. Thank you so much for stopping
too.
By.
Thank you.
I hate to keep using that. That's your line. I owe you some money for that. Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. And if you'd like to reach the 51%, contact us at advertising@51%conversations.com. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.